Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you're listening, you're probably looking for that knowledge shortcut on something, well, pretty important, how to invest your money while staying true to your faith. Today, we're doing a deep exploration into halal investing. That means financial strategies allowed under Sharia law. It can seem complex, you know, where ethics meet finance. Our sources really dig into this, looking at regulations, new products, especially in places like Saudi Arabia. And they show that, yes, you absolutely can build wealth successfully within these guidelines.
That's exactly right. And it's more than just finding specific products. It's about grasping a whole philosophy of finance, one that really values ethical behavior and, importantly, shared responsibility. So for you listening, we're going to unpack those absolute must-know rules of Islamic finance. Then we'll look at the smart financial tools available, stocks, bond alternatives, all sorts that let you grow your portfolio without compromising your values.
Okay, so before we even think about where to put money, we need to get the foundation right, the why. This isn't just about returns, is it? It's about business being, well, a force for good, too. What are those core ethical filters, the ones that decide if something's permissible or not?
Yeah, there are essentially five core principles. Think of them like powerful screens, and they immediately filter out a huge chunk of the conventional financial world. First up, and probably the most well-known, is the strict ban on riba. Now, we often just translate that as no interest.
Right.
But it's deeper than just avoiding a fee. Riba essentially forbids making money from money without actual productive effort, so just lending cash and collecting interest. That's out.
Okay, so if you can't earn just by lending capital, how do investors get a return? That must bring in this idea of fairness, of sharing the outcome, right?
Yeah, exactly. You hit it. If you can't be a lender with a guaranteed return, you have to be more like a partner. And that brings us to the second principle. Shared risk and reward. It means the investment has to be set up so that both the person providing the money, the investor, and the person running the business, the entrepreneur, share in the ups and the downs, the profits and the losses. And there are specific ways this is done. Structures like Mudharaba, that's where one partner provides capital, the other provides expertise, and they split profits based on an agreed ratio. And then there's Mushaka. In that one, both sides put in capital. Both are involved in managing things, and they share the outcome together.
That's interesting because, you know, technically, buying regular stocks involves shared risk. Your shares can go down if the company does badly. So how are these Islamic concepts, Mudharaba and Mushaka, different from just, say, buying shares on the New York Stock Exchange?
Yeah, good question. The key difference often lies in the, let's say, the ethical intent and the actual contract structure. In conventional stockholding, your responsibility can be quite passive, right?
Right, you just own a tiny piece.
Exactly. But in these Islamic partnership models, there's often a more direct, tangible link and responsibility for how the venture actually performs. It's an explicit shared liability designed specifically to avoid that guaranteed sort of unproductive return that riba represents.
That clarifies things. Okay, moving on from the structure to the actual business, what about the industries themselves? Are some just off limits?
Definitely. That's a third principle. Avoiding haram or forbidden industries, you absolutely cannot invest in companies involved in things considered harmful or unethical under Islamic law. So the usual suspects are things like alcohol, gambling, pork, weapons manufacturing, pornography, and also businesses that make too much of their money from interest-based activities.
Okay.
Then the fourth principle really gets to financial stability, avoiding gharar. This basically means avoiding transactions with excessive uncertainty or risk or speculation. The idea is to steer clear of high-risk bets that could cause harm or be manipulative.
Avoiding excessive speculation. What does that mean in practice for someone who's maybe used to, I don't know, volatile tech stocks or derivatives?
It means the deals need to involve tangible, real assets. The sources emphasize this money should be backed by something concrete. And this tie to real assets, it actually acts as a kind of systemic stabilizer. It helps explain why Islamic finance sometimes avoids the worst impacts of certain credit crises or speculative bubbles you see elsewhere.
I see.
Because the foundation is always a real product or a lease or a commodity, not just a financial promise built on layers of debt.
That's a really powerful point. The ethical rule itself promotes stability. Okay, and the fifth principle. Sounds like a broader moral guide.
It really is the ethical heart of it, ethical intent. The view is that money is a trust. So investments should actively back ventures that are useful, fair, and contribute positively to society. And when you look at regulations, say, in places like Saudi Arabia, the authorities, the central bank, the capital market authority, they don't just check for riba. They check that the underlying intent and the structure align with Sharia compliance. It reflects that sense of responsibility.
Okay, let's bridge this to the real world then. We've got these non-negotiables. No interest, shared risk, avoid harmful industries, no wild speculation, positive intent. Once you apply all those filters, what's actually left? What are the practical ways you could build a solid portfolio? Where does the money go?
Well, even with these strict rules, the options are actually quite substantial, and they're growing. There's a whole sophisticated global industry supporting this. First off, you've got Sharia-compliant stocks. Now, these aren't just, you know, stocks and companies that happen not to sell alcohol.
Right.
There are companies that have been through a really rigorous screening process.
Yeah.
The screeners look at things like debt levels because too much debt involves riba. And they check that any non-compliant income sources, the haram stuff, are really minimal. Often the threshold is something like less than 5% of total revenue.
So it's not just what they sell, it's how they run their finances too. Their balance sheet matters.
Exactly.
And where do people find these screen stocks?
Well, many are listed on global indexes nowadays. But if you're looking regionally, the Saudi Stock Exchange, the Tadawul, is a major hub. Lots of companies there operate within these guidelines from the get-go, which can make things simpler for local investors.
And for people who maybe want professional management, diversification, without having to pick individual stocks, Islamic mutual funds sound like a solid choice.
Oh, absolutely. Islamic mutual funds are a great option. They're professionally managed portfolios investing only in halal assets. And what's really crucial is the ongoing management. The fund managers don't just screen stocks once. They constantly monitor the companies. So if a company in the fund suddenly takes on too much debt or maybe gets into a non-compliant line of business, the fund has to sell those shares to stay compliant.
Okay, now let's tackle the one that often causes confusion.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative to a conventional bond. Bonds are basically loans with interest, right?
Okay.
So how can you have an Islamic bond? This is where Sukuk comes in, I believe.
Yes, Sukuk. It's a really vital innovation. See, a conventional bond is basically an IOU. The issuer owes the investor money, and the interest is the charge for that loan. Sukuk, on the other hand, represent a share of ownership. Ownership in a tangible asset, or maybe a specific business venture or project. Let's take an example. Say a government wants to build an airport. Instead of issuing a normal bond, borrowing money, and promising interest, they might issue sukuk. The sukuk holders then effectively own a piece of the airport project. Their return comes from things like profit sharing or maybe leasing fees generated by that actual asset. It neatly sidesteps riba.
That makes it much clearer. It's about ownership, not debt.
Yeah.
And that theme, needing a real asset behind the investment, that must apply to more traditional wealth building too.
It does. Real estate, for instance, is generally seen as a very sound and halal way to build wealth. The main condition, again, is that the property isn't used for anything prohibited.
Makes sense.
And similarly, things like gold and commodities are permissible, but the way you trade them matters. You can't just trade paper promises. Islamic finance rules usually require immediate payment and actual physical delivery to avoid that gharar, the speculation element.
Right. You have to actually possess it.
Precisely. And finally, for ease and accessibility, modern finance offers tools like Sharia-compliant ETFs, exchange-traded funds. These basically track indexes made up only of screened halal companies. So they offer a simple, diversified way to invest, available globally. And our sources even mention specific platforms like Gamma Assets that help investors by providing tools for checking compliance and accessing these kinds of curated halal investments.
Okay, there's this common idea, maybe a misconception, that because you're cutting out huge parts of the market, conventional banks, highly leveraged firms, sin stocks,
Yeah. You
must be limiting your diversification and therefore your potential profits. Is that just the price you pay for sticking to your principles?
Yeah.
Low return?
That's a really important question. And the evidence generally suggests, no, not necessarily. You're not automatically penalized financially for being ethical. You can certainly achieve solid returns, but the way you earn those returns, the structure, is different. The sources compare them clearly. Conventional finance uses interest. Halal uses profit loss sharing. Conventional shifts risk. Halal shares it. Conventional embraces speculation. Halal demands real assets.
Mm-hmm.
So while halal investing might exclude certain high-flying, high-risk sectors, its built-in focus on long-term value and avoiding excessive debt often results in returns that are less volatile, more stable over time. It changes the risk profile fundamentally.
So if I'm investing within these rules, what are the key strategies to maximize returns? If I can't chase those highly leveraged speculative gains, what's the playbook?
You really lean into the strengths of the approach itself. First, diversification is absolutely crucial. Because some sectors are off-limits, you need to be thoughtful about mixing your halal assets. Spread investments across different compliant stocks, maybe some real estate, some sukuk.
Spread the risk.
Exactly. Second, the nature of avoiding speculation almost forces a long-term focus. This patient buy-and-hold approach is, a classic strategy for building wealth anyway, and without high leverage, these portfolios often handle market bumps a bit more smoothly. And third, something we touched on earlier, regular review. This isn't optional. A company's situation can change. They might take on new debt that makes them non-compliant tomorrow. So you have to keep checking your portfolio. This is where working with specialized advisors or using dedicated platforms becomes really valuable. They understand both finance and the Sharia requirements for that ongoing oversight.
So boiling it all down for someone starting out today, it sounds like it requires active engagement and real clarity about your own ethics.
Absolutely. It comes back to that idea of money as a trust. You, the investor, are responsible for how that trust is managed. It's about growing your wealth in a way that genuinely aligns with your deepest values. So the practical steps. First, define your goals. Why are you investing? Retirement, buying a house. Knowing your objective helps shape your strategy. Second, verify compliance. Seriously, check for certifications from recognized Sharia boards or scholars. Use those screening tools that platforms offer. Don't just assume.
And if something seems a bit unclear or complicated.
That's where the advice is. Avoid gray area deals. If an investment feels murky, overly complex, maybe too good to be true, it probably doesn't meet the standard of clarity needed to avoid gharar. Better to be cautious.
Your advice.
And finally, keep learning. Islamic finance isn't static, it's an evolving field. New products emerge. Staying informed about the market is always key to success.
This has been really illuminating. Our deep dive shows there's a whole range of sophisticated, robust options out there, from sukuk linked to real assets to carefully screened stocks and ETFs. It proves you can pursue serious wealth growth while staying true to really powerful ethical principles like sharing risk and insisting on tangible value. So for you listening, know that you can grow your wealth in a way that feels right.
Indeed. And maybe a final thought to leave you with. If this approach, Islamic finance, mandates ethical screening, forces investors towards tangible assets, towards shared responsibility, away from pure speculation, how might that fundamental philosophy, that insistence on real value and shared outcomes, potentially influence or maybe even inspire broader global investment trends, towards more sustainability, more social responsibility in the years ahead? It makes you think about what value really means in finance, doesn't it?